Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you to the studios from K-Goat Radio here in Idaho Springs, Colorado, and that of course is the center of the universe. And this is Writer's Talk, visiting here with Alin Riggs, and Alin Riggs is a sci-fi author, and Alin, welcome.
Thank you, I'm very glad to be up here.
All right, and you have already written a series. You're in the midst of writing a series now. It's called The Stone's Blade. The Stone's Blade, so Stone's possessive here. And you're in the midst of it now. I believe you have two works out?
Two right now. The third book will be out later this month, and there is a fourth in the works.
All right. And I remember reading the first couple of them, and you're just a great creative author. And we visited before with you on the Stone's Blades and the series there. But I'm wondering if we could just do a little bit of recap on what episodes one and episodes two entail.
Well, the first book, The Blood, is where a planet needs to have a cure for their people, otherwise they will become extinct. And that cure is a child born on another planet, and they send someone out to pick her up, basically. And a crash happens, and the pilot is the only one who survives, and he has to figure out how to locate the child and take her back to his home planet to save his people.
All right. And you have the Stone's Blades, and you work a lot with knives or blades in there. I'm curious about that, in that it's not like phasers or something like in Star Trek. Why that, and what's the meaning?
The social network of the planets, Rakira and Terramar, are based on a blade culture. The stones are alien creatures who communicate telepathically with music and song, and their crystal blades also do some form of communication. But the blades are very important for the protection of the stones. So the people are protecting the stones. They're singers.
Okay, so the stones actually have a life to them then. They're not just inanimate objects in any way.
They look like very large crystals.
Okay.
And they are different colors depending on, the Anyala stone is green and the Paricha stone is amber and the Kitta stone is blue.
Any significance to the colors as to the symbolism of the colors, or is this just a random?
Basically, kind of a random collection of colors. Green is my favorite color, so of course that's the Anyala stone, and that's the stone that has more precedence in the first book.
Okay. All right. So, and I'm intrigued because I'm not a sci-fi writer, but I'm fascinated by the process that you sci-fi writers go through. And, whether it's in creating characters and location, and we're going to get into language and everything. I'm curious, where does this come from? I write in personal human experiences, something here, but this is something different. You really put it out there.
Well, the beginning of this whole series began with a short story that I wrote when I was a teenager. And the characters never let go in my mind. And by the time I hit college, I thought, yeah, there's enough here for a book. So I started writing that. I don't really know where it comes from. Characters show up in dreams and tell me what I should be writing, not what I just wrote sometimes. And it feels very real to me, because I can have conversations with those characters.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes arguments.
Yeah, I remember when we talked the last time, and you had said that how these characters, they might just appear like out of a dream or some other, and they become very real. So it's a way like perhaps bringing them into consciousness from the unconscious. Is that a good way of putting it?
I think so. In the writing process, sometimes you get in a real groove and you just start writing, and magic happens. I mean, that's the only way I can explain it. I have a character that showed up in the back corner of a room, and I had no idea who she was. She had two lines in The Balance, which is the second book, and she just seemed to stick with me, but it has taken me a while to figure out who she is. Mm-hmm. And she really starts to come to the forefront in the third book, which will be published hopefully later this month.
Wow. As Mr. Spock would say on Star Trek, fascinating.
Yes.
How these characters come about and who they are and what they do. You had one character, and he seemed to be a heroic type, and I can't remember his name. Is it Renal or something?
Ren Lare.
Ren Lare. He was in the second book, and he, right? Was he in the first as well?
He's in the first one. He's the pilot.
Ah, okay. And talk about him a little bit. I was pretty intrigued by his role, because he had to help bring the blood back and everything. So that got into a lot of conflict there.
Yes, he has a history of being late for everything, and so when he's also a very experienced, phenomenal pilot of the starships that they use to travel. And when he takes the rescue crew to Terramar to find the child, something very interesting happens. A time bubble bursts and it causes a crash. And he's the only survivor. And he doesn't discover until halfway through the book that he has arrived late.
Mm-hmm.
Very late, about 20 years later than planned. And so he is plagued by his apparent failure to save his planet, because he doesn't know whether or not his home planet, Rakira, has survived this plague, because he's now 20 years late.
Wow. Okay. So you're then in your storytelling, you're playing with time elements here, time warp.
Yes. Time moves has been moved forward around Terramar, just one planet or one solar system, and it has not moved forward everywhere else. So he's actually will be giving away a few things,
yeah.
You know,
spoiler
but
alert. Yep.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
when he gets back to Rakira with the child, he really has only been gone about 3 months.
In Rakira, I guess.
Of Rakiran time.
Yeah, okay. And that's an interesting, and we'll come back to the language. I'm intrigued by that. Rakiran. Because there, time has essentially just continued on, but in Terramar time, it has, gone into a different, and I kind of think of like how we just did that experiment with a couple of astronauts, I think it was the Kelly brothers, and one was in space and the other was on the planet, they're twins, and the time that the faster you move, according to Einstein, the slower time moves, or the faster time, whichever. And so he would not have aged as much as his twin brother did on Earth. Is that something you're kind of working with a bit?
Kind of. The time bubble is something that was created by the stones of Rakura. So when one of those stones is attacked, the time bubble is wrecked, basically.
Okay.
And it leaps forward twice as far as it was intended.
Okay, so I would imagine then by the time Ren appears on Terramar, which is kind of equivalent, maybe roughly like the Earth or something.
Something, yes.
Yeah, you know, like at the, our, what we can identify.
They are human-looking aliens.
Species.
Yeah,
okay.
Species. Yeah.
Okay. Then the child that he was to bring back is no longer a child.
That's correct, and that's kind of the fun part.
There's where the story gets complicated.
Yes, okay. Very complicated.
And that's what we like to hear. We like stories with complications in. All right, this is fascinating here because, you know, we talked about the character and how they come to you and how they get created, and you start giving them form in some way or another. And then location, the setting, where is it? Where are these places here? You know, so, yeah, go ahead.
Terramar is an Earth-like planet. There are no primates on this planet. And so their scientists are just now kind of wondering how their species appeared on this planet because there's nothing like them. And it's, they are just now experimenting with satellites and the possibility of space travel. They're sort of alien phobic in certain portions of their society, which also comes into play.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And let's talk about the language, because I stubborn. So the home planet, if you will, well, Rakuren. I'm intrigued by that because of the complexity of the word itself. Okay, and I think of, for example, like in the Star Trek movies, and one of the latest ones in which Leonard Nimoy, this is a few years ago, reappears. He's much older, but then there's his youthful self in there, and they're having this battle with the Klingons, and the language that the Klingons use while they're on the ship. Talk about that and why words matter and how you form them, how they come about.
It's sometimes the words just appear in my head. And sometimes I create them myself. I have a tendency to look at misspelled words and rearrange letters. So when you look at Ren Loray, that's actually a reworked word of Chevrolet, you know, like the car.
Mm-hmm.
And that name actually appeared, I actually had a name for him finally by the time I was in college. And for some reason, Ren Loray just sounded perfect for him. I have another character that started out as Caesar, going off of the word Caesar. And every time I was reading aloud, I had difficulty saying the word Caesar when I needed to speak about that character. So the name did not fit like I thought it would. And in a discussion with another writer, I sort of, in frustration, said, what I need is a 2x4, because we were talking about the character and his behavior and how stubborn he was and stuff. And I needed a 2x4, you know, to hit him between the ears, you know, like a donkey, you know, because he was a stupid donkey. He was so focused.
Stubborn. Okay.
Stubborn donkey. And my writer friend said, that's his name. And I was like, how can stubborn donkey be a name? And she said, play with it. And so what happened was his name became Steuben Dalkey.
Nice.
And it fit, and I love the name. Unfortunately, he dies in the first book.
Okay.
But, does keep cropping up occasionally. So.
Well, and that's critical. And by the way, I want to remind our listening audience, this is Jerry Fabianic in KYGT Studios in Clear Creek County, Colorado, visiting here with author Lynn Riggs and talking about her series, The Stone's Blade. And we're talking about language, of course. And language, because of our ear, when you said like Ren Leray, it's softer. And so you kind of, to me, you're almost like he's a nice guy sort of thing. Whereas Steuben, you know, almost is like put offish and something like that. And so to work with our acoustics, our ear, and how we hear certain letters, the more harsh letters, for example, the K, the L, the R, or something like that, gives a more harsh as opposed to a softer S sound. Is that something that comes into play?
Sometimes it does come into play. So again, going back to the Cesar Steuben Dalkey, Cesar was softer. Even though I wanted it to, you know, be more Caesar-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But the Steuben Dalkey just seemed more firm, solid, okay. Tunnel vision type
okay.
name.
Okay. Yeah. So names are important and how they come together, how they fit with the character there and how they sound to the ear, because it certainly has certain connotations with them.
Right. And Ren Leray, he is kind of a softer, he understands people.
Mm-hmm.
He's not warlike at all, but he has a love for the stars and the stones. And it's the ending of his name with the E-T, as in Chevrolet,
mm-hmm.
Is societal, a socially societal name on Rakira. It's a formal, more older ending to a name, you know, like Eleanor or, Nancy or something like that. Here, it's an older name, and so it evokes the past for the Rakiran people.
And it, in Ireland, and the way you describe him, he sounds like a romantic character.
Yes, he is very.
When you said he loves the stars, so he's, and he's habitually late.
Yes.
So he's not one who looks at his clock and has to be on time sort of thing there. And while that could be very frustrating to type A, very structured personalities, some people, you know, that's just the way we are, you know, here it is.
Yes. And that's going to, it has plagued him, you know, and he can't figure out why he's always late. And when he discovers he shows up actually early to his first introduction to the stone that will give him his path.
Yeah.
When he's told how he's going to be involved in the rescue of the blood.
Yeah. It's kind of like a dreamer.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I love it. Okay. This is stuff that writers, when we are creating a work, whether it's sci-fi, romance, murder mystery, whatever it might be, literary fiction such as what I write, the name connotates a certain element about that individual, him or her. And so you kind of have to go with it. So that's awesome in the way you're doing it.
Yeah, it's exciting when coming up with a new character. Mm-hmm. The name, it takes a while sometimes to come up with. The woman that showed up in the back corner, it took halfway through writing the third book to actually come up with her name and to actually realize that her character had been mentioned in the very first book, which was fascinating to me, that she would, you know, a very, very minor character would show up later as a very important character. And so her name was kind of fun to play with. Yeah. I wanted it to be sarin, after the sarin gas.
Okay.
As being very poisonous, because that's her character, is kind of a poisonous character.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes a really cool bad person.
Yeah.
And but because sarin sounded too similar to the sheriff's name Taryn, I had to rework that so you wouldn't get confused, especially if you heard a audio version of it. So sarin and Taryn sounded too similar. So her name ended up being Sarine.
Oh, okay. And stick with that. One, the consideration that you just mentioned there, that you can't have two characters' names are very similar, because on the audio, you know, it might be confused. So that's a practical consideration, but to stay within context of that. And then, like Ren, being this romantic dreamer, now you have Serene, who is a little bit more acerbic or poisonous in there, but very rich characters.
Yeah, they're really a lot of fun. They have lots of different levels. Serene is still struggling with her circumstances. She was the communications officer on the first crew to go to Terramar to come up with a cure for the disease that was killing all the women on Rakura. And the bursting of the time bubble ruined her communications array, and she was no longer able to communicate with home for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And so she has some real difficulty dealing with her individual problems.
Right.
And it comes up to sort of smack her in the face, but she has some redeeming values.
Well, and that's to develop a character who is rounded, so rounded that they might be off-putting initially, but then, as you say, has redeeming qualities, because many of us are that way. And we're not all dreamers or romantics, you know, kind of like Ren. And that life gets in the way of stuff. And sometimes it's just harsh and you get dealt a bad blow. And yet underneath all that is a very warm individual that once you get to know him or her, you kind of like him or her. And that's what I compliment you on, the development of these characters.
Yeah, and when life, you know, sneaks up and smacks you with something completely different, the underlying theme of the series is discovering and accepting your true self. And it's not just for the individual characters that this is true. It's going to be for two entire societies who have discovered that they're not who they thought they were.
That's fascinating. And what we're going to do, Lynn, is we're going to take a break here for station identification. And when we come back, I want to pick up with that theme there, the not only the underlying theme of the series, but what it's like to write a series such as what you're doing here and how the story is unfolding. So, all right, everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, visiting up here in the studios of the K-Goat in Clear Creek County, Colorado, and we will be back momentarily. Okay, everyone. Hey, yeah, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9 in the studios up here of the K-Goat. And we're in Clear Creek County, Colorado, downtown Idaho Springs in the loft of the United Center, visiting here on Writer's Talk with Lynn Riggs and talking about her series, The Stone's Blade. And we've been having a great discussion up till now just on the mechanics of writing. So, Lynn, that's awesome.
Well, thank you. It's a work of joy and pleasure. I've never been happier.
That is awesome. That is terrific. Yeah, and we find ourselves in there when you can kind of escape. Is there a certain time of the day, by the way, you get in there or ideas just show up whenever you get up first thing in the morning? Do you plan stuff out?
Each of the books has been written in a slightly different way.
Okay.
The first book, The Blood, was pretty much from beginning to end. Sort of wrote myself into a corner occasionally, but through editing, we fixed it before it actually went to print. But we have the second book, you know, they all just sort of run in together. The first book was supposed to be originally a standalone. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that to get things really going, actually one of my daughters came up with a question about what if, and instantly it became at least three books. And as I was writing the second book, I realized that the third book was going to end up being 800 pages long if I was going to tie up all the little loose ends for the different sub-stories and stuff. So I thought, okay, now I'm going to have to, it's going to be not just a trilogy, but a quartet of books. And so the original... Now the original, The Stone's Blade, which has become the series, we have The Blood, The Balance, and The Blades. So the third book, The Blades, which will be coming out soon, has been really a lot of fun to write, but we've had to go back and reread what was actually published in the first two books, because sometimes scenes are remembered differently after you've written and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten.
Okay.
And so you have to go back and find out what was actually published, because readers are going to catch you on it if
Right.
you misremember. And I know my editor and I had to go back to the first two books because we both remembered a particular scene being in one of them, and we couldn't find it. So it was actually a scene that had been cut, and so I couldn't have the characters remembering that scene in the third book.
Right.
So it was really a lot of fun to, you know, figure that out, you know, trying to figure out what version was, you know, that scene in.
I like the way you emphasized fun.
yeah, it was just really a lot of fun.
It was
intriguing to me that both the editor and I remembered the same scene.
Right.
But when we both went back and read the two published books, the scene was not there. And so it was kind of a wake-up call that we had to be really careful about how we were writing each book to make sure that we didn't have those kinds of things happen. that, you know, scenes that were not in the first two books were remembered or discussed in the future books.
Right. Because the writers, it becomes not a blur, but a whole package. And it was in your original writing. So the brain, the memory is there.
Right.
What kind of, in a good way, kind of cuts that off is the editing process. You just chose not to include that particular one. So that kind of gets, you know, interrupted there. However, but the original brain gets back. What other challenges? Are there other challenges? Because you're writing a series. And this is done over a period of years.
You have to have a basic framework. We begin here. This is kind of what we think is going to happen, and this is where we're going to end up. You sort of have to know where you're going to end up, you know, your goal, and then the process of the sort of the race to get to that goal. You know, how many scenes, what major things are you going to cover in which book?
Okay.
And that was what led to the third book, The Blades, being divided in half, because I had so many things to tie up,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't do it in 400 or fewer pages. And so we divided it in half, and we decided which things we had to end with to tie up, and which sub-stories or subplots to continue to the next book. And that next book is titled The Seventh Stone.
Okay.
And yes, it's different than The Blood, The Balance, and The Blades, but we couldn't come up with another B word that made any sense. So, yeah. But it does make sense when you read it.
Right. And that could be, you know, what sets, it's the wrap up in a way. It brings everything together. It's not a standalone, but it sets itself apart from the first three, the progression up to that point.
Right. It is the conclusion of the prophecy of the blood and the balance.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm thinking that one of the challenges of writing a series, you're bringing it up, and I put it in context of writing a good book that flows from chapter to chapter. How do you wrap up a chapter without being just a cold ending? Still brings conclusion, wrap up to a certain point, but once you want the reader to be anticipating and wanting to move on to the next chapter.
Right. And we had to choose which storyline we were going to bring to conclusion and yet also have that hint that there's one more or there's another step in the whole process.
Yeah.
And I think I did a good job on the blood leading into the balance. And so the blood talks about the character who is the blood, Ani, and at the end of it, they discover that there's another character that they need to go find, who is the balance. And so the storyline, the main storyline in the balance is about finding that individual and taking them back to Rakira to save the Anyala Stone.
Wow. Yeah. And that's I think when the listeners and the readers hearing from an author these points, the complexity of putting together a story, not only in your case, but others who wrote at least a trilogy, even, you know, like a two-set novel, that the complexity, as I say, from moving from one story to the next and keeping the flow, keeping the story there, and still wrapping up loose ends, to review, to make sure that whatever you're talking about in books, in this case, 3 and 4, actually did happen in books 1 and 2.
Yeah.
It reminds me, and I don't want to get too far off, but there was when I was teaching, I would teach The Great Gatsby. And there's this great scene in the film version with Mia Farrow and Robert Redford. And my fellow teacher, who was brilliant, and she had read the book. I mean, we both knew the book. We're absolutely convinced it was in the story. It wasn't in the original Fitzgerald story. It was in the film version. But I had seen both, or read and seen both, and I just simply mixed them.
Yes. And, I mean, that happens to me. I mean, and I, in a way, want that to happen to my readers.
Mm-hmm.
That I want to give them just enough that they can imagine some other scenes or something between them. And I have discovered that I have done that, where I have read, Anne McCafferty's The Dragon Riders of Pern. I could swear that there were certain scenes in certain books, but going back 20 years later and rereading them,
yeah,
those scenes aren't there. And I wonder, okay, so that was my imagination as the reader going beyond what the writer gave me. And that's the escapism that,
right,
and the entertainment value of, I would say, particularly science fiction and fantasy.
I love that. Yeah, the escapism, because you go into another realm completely. And while the reader certainly has gone there with you in this other realm, nonetheless, and maybe 90% of the readers would not pick up on that fact that this particular scene was not in, or was portrayed in a different light, that 10% or even the one who does, and so is critical. Because then it shows the importance of, you know, the accuracy and how you have to be very structured and left brain in that there, because if one inaccuracy could undermine the whole work.
Right. And that has led me to get more structured in the writing process as we've gone further into the series, because we have to be more structured. We have to pay closer attention to the storyline and what has happened so that we can aim more closely to our end goal.
Right. Yeah. So that balance between allowing creativity to flow, being the pantser just right, and yet still,
yes,
the planning and structure.
Right. And it's learning how to write to an outline has been a real interesting thing, because I've never really done that before. The first book was not written to an outline. It was just written. And the second book had to be a little bit more focused. And the third book even more so. And now I'm in the process of writing that, or designing that outline for the fourth book. What sub stories are going to be tied up and which ones are going to be created.
And this is where a great editor is so crucial, and you and I share one.
Yes, Melanie Mulhall with Dragonheart has been phenomenal.
Yeah.
She has really bought into the story and helps me see things straight. Sometimes we argue about it.
Mm-hmm.
I win about half of them.
Mm-hmm.
that
many?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Lately, I've been, able to win about half of them.
Good.
And but we're together. We're writing this. She has made me a much better writer. Her coaching has been phenomenal, and she believes in this story.
And that's huge right there. In this case here, like with Melanie, but others who connect with that relationship with the editor, who believes in what you're writing, can get it and then say, okay, here's some things we need to work on. Here's some stuff here because then he or she can stand back and look at the larger picture, because you're so immersed into the story, you're not into all these little details, but someone else who comes in with a critical eye, like a great editor like Melanie, certainly could zero in and then, you know, set you on a correct path again, on a good path.
Right. Sometimes she just has to say, you know, I don't think this is how the character would really react. Let's think about this. Let's talk about it. And then she'll say, you just go do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll look at it again. Yeah. And most of the time it works.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, so I'm going to just remind our audience, this is Jerry Fabianic and KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103. We're on Writer's Talk here with Alin Riggs, sci-fi writer. And Alin, let's talk about, now you got the third book, and it's called The Blades.
Yes.
In the, what's going to be a quartet, or the quadrilogy.
turns out quadrilogy just doesn't sound right, but quartet does, especially because music plays such a
beautiful,
a big part of this series. The Stones communicate through music and color.
Yeah.
And there is music and dance in each one of the books.
And music also gives resonance to light waves, too. So, you know, we look at the spectrum and something really heavy, loud, might be on the more of the red sound, you know. Yeah.
And you know, the lighter colored ones, the stones, like the Kidd Stone, which is kind of a light denim blue in my mind.
Uh-huh.
And it has a very soft, lilting song. Voice. You know, I can't really say, you know, soprano, baritone, bass, whatever. But each one of the Stones has a slightly different voice, and it reflects in the color that they are.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to have amethyst in there, would you?
amethyst, the purple stone, is what will become the balance becomes that stone center.
I love it.
So
there
are other stones out there, not just the first three. So there's a total of seven. So that's where the fourth book comes into play with the seventh stone. We hope that, I expect that they will find the seventh stone, and then the pathways will be open between some planets, and the people of Rakura and Terramar will have the opportunity to evolve to the next step.
Nice. Okay, now you've given me even more incentive to keep reading, because I got to find out, where am I in this story? That's great stuff. It's fun. Okay, so you're in the process of getting this published now, and already it is being printed and everything, get it out there. But you were telling me you got some like contest and some things, and you're looking at some feedback from your readers on what, you know, so why don't you talk about that?
For the final book of the quartet, The Seventh Stone, I have a third planet that I'm struggling to name. And so I've decided that I would like the readers to help name this third planet. I have no idea myself, and I'm hoping that the readers, you know, who have come to enjoy the first books of this, will come up with something new and different.
What will that planet be? What's its purpose or role as compared to the other two?
It is the planet of origin of the Seven Stones, and they were given the people to guard them, to sort of take care of them. They're the guardian stones of the people. And they see an asteroid coming Of course, the people cannot see the asteroid coming, and the stones decide that they must, in order to save their people, they need to divide them and put them in two safe places so that after the asteroid hits, one of the stones will stay behind and create its own time bubble around the planet, and it will sing two songs, basically, a time song as well as a song of healing. And so while the other two populations on Rakura and Terramar go forward with their lives, the seventh stone is by itself on this planet for 1,000 years, singing a time song and a song of healing to recover from this asteroid hit.
Okay, so the just backing up a little bit, then the inhabitants of both planets, Terramar and Rakura, are actually come from the same root.
They come from the same root. And that's why their blade culture is so similar, and that they have similar celebratory dances, and singing is all important. And it's discovering that they're not who they really are. They think they know, but then they, through this process of finding the blood and the balance, they discover that they're not who they are, that they belong to a much, they're so much more.
It sounds somewhat familiar to us Earthlings, right? In terms of how we talk about race and ethnicity. And the bottom line is we're all human, all Homo sapiens. And so what great lessons, you know, to draw there. But it goes back to your underlying theme then of identity, not only within the individual, but also with the other, with the species itself.
Right, right. And then so they will have the opportunity to return to a home that has been healed and is now ready to, they'll be able to survive on their home planet. And not everybody will choose to visit their home, their origin planet, not everyone will decide to move on to the next evolution of the species.
Wow. Okay. Then it sounds like another series might come after the quartet, in which case...
we're leaving the door open. Don't have anything planned as such, but we're leaving the door open.
Okay, this is great stuff here. So, you know, you're inviting your readers then to give you feedback. You're running a contest. How will this work?
What I would like them to do is to have read at least the first two books.
Okay.
And then I need basically the word or the name. Does it have, you know, what kind of background does it have? Is it made up? Or did you play with, you know, play on words? And this can include other languages, you know, here on Earth. I mean, there are hundreds, thousands of languages here on Earth. And you can use, you know, a foreign language word, and we can mix it up, whatever. So if you use a different word, I'd like to know what the definition is, and I'd like to know how you, the reader, feels the word for this planet would fit into the series.
Wow. Yeah, and I think, you know, and my own, and I don't want to put ideas into anyone's head there, but I think of disappearing languages in our world, especially like our Native American languages, and how words from them, whether it's theirs or another, might be a way of again, bringing consciousness to the readers, you know, how did this, and then carry it forward into your story. So I'd like you to comment on that. But then also, are you looking for more than just a name? Would there be any other language? I think, again, I'm going to go back to the example in Star Trek with the Klingons and the language, the, you know, like this.
There is a written language that is talked about on two different, or on Rakira and on Terramar. There is archaeological evidence of this first language on Rakira. It's called Ancient Rakiran. Mm-hmm. It is like Latin is today. Very few people speak it. Only the singers speak it, and
okay.
Or those really into, you know, scholars would speak it. And on Terramar, it's a dead language. They don't remember it. Nobody speaks it as such, but it has evolved on one of the continents into what's called Southern, and it has hints of the ancient Rakiran language in it. I forgot where we were going.
Well, it's just, creating language. And I had mentioned, using Native American languages or other languages that are disappearing from them. But then you also bring in this other element of root words. So, the English language is a blend between the Latin and the Germanic Teutonic languages, and we have others come in as well, words that are just recently coined, but then that we adopt from the Hindi language, for example.
Right. I find it interesting that you bring up the Native American languages, because ever since the beginning of this story, the characters have looked to me in my mind's eye as Native Americans.
Wow, okay.
And some of the words, like the planet name Rakira, I have been informed by some Native Americans of the Sioux tribe that it appears to them to be a combination of two tribal names, which and Rakira is a word that just came to me. I had no idea where or why. I've never heard the word before, but it's been there. So bizarrely, you know, some form of subconscious brings in the Native American language and their appearances, you know, all different shades of cinnamon brown to the more reddish colorations, mm-hmm. to almost black mm-hmm. coloring of the skin. But they do have different colored eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the blue, green, just like we have here. In fact, Taryn, the sheriff, makes a comment that he wonders if every singer has to have the color eyes that their stones are. And the stones kind of laugh about that and say, some of us are colors that your species it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Well, and I would just, I'm not going to qualify with conditional would. I don't think it's bizarre. You say bizarrely comes up from the unconscious. It does. And so where does this come from? You simply write the story, and then you get out there, and there are other people who look at this and say, wow, you know, this has shades of this or that. And you go like, I hadn't even thought of that. It wasn't intentional.
Exactly. It was not... necessarily intentional on my part. It's just that's the way the story is.
That's what great writing is right. all about, too. So,
right.
All right. So people want to contribute to, they want to get your books. They want to get into the contest. They got ideas. How can they do it? What's your website? What's the methodology of this?
You can message me at alin@timberdark.com.
Okay.
So that would be the email that you can send to me, or you can contact me through my Facebook page, Timberdark Publications, LLC, on Facebook. And you can send me a private message or something, because I need your email address at a minimum, along with the name of the planet that you are proposing. And if you just want to say, hey, I need more information about this, you can email me at alin@timberdark.com.
Spell Alin for us.
alin@timberdark.com.
All right. And hopefully the book is going to be available.
I am really hoping that the Blades will be out later in September, hopefully, if my book designer gets his acting gear.
Okay, and if you're listening to this later, after September, the book's already out there and probably on Amazon and certainly on Timberdark website.
Yes.
All mm-hmm. right. Okay. All right, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. Visiting here with Alin Riggs, author of the Stones Blade series on Writer's Talk here. And we'll be back with more authors down the road. So hopefully you enjoy this and take care now. Bye.